they were telling me that they worked in their sleep, which was something I never in my life would have thought of. And I think is really interesting and kind of nightmarish in terms of thinking of people being turned into machines in a sense.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound, conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. When it comes to journalism, Alice Driver is not afraid to try the hard stuff. Her recent piece on lobster divers in Honduras was a finalist for a James Beard Award. And she spent years talking to immigrant workers at Tyson Chicken Plants in her home state of Arkansas, documenting injuries and deaths from a chemical spill in 2011 and COVID in 2020, as well as the normal, brutal wear and tear of every day on the processing line. Alice turned those interviews into a series of articles, and now into a book called Life and Death of the American Worker. The book takes you inside the hard blue-collar work that we now count on immigrants to do, so the rest of us don't have to. And it shows how those immigrants are trying to organize and fight back against one of the most powerful companies in America. Not only that, Alice and I talk about a completely different project she has coming up. A collection of letters between her mother and Mari Sendak, the famous author of Where the Wild Things Are. And the story of how that happened is a wild thing in itself. Here's our conversation. This story you did at a high degree of difficulty. You are talking to employees at a very powerful company, and the employees are some of them undocumented, many of them speak little or no English, and they are rightfully afraid of not just the company, but maybe any outsider. So how do you, as a white woman from Arkansas, get in there and get them to trust you?
In terms of my background that relates to this book, I was born in the Ozark Mountains in a very small town. And probably because of that, I also really wanted to, once I got out of Arkansas, I really wanted to learn another language. And I studied Spanish in college and then got a PhD in Spanish and did a postdoc at the National University in Mexico City. So where I was then, I was based in Mexico City as a journalist. So I'm fluent in Spanish, and I've worked for years as a journalist at the intersection of immigration and labor rights. And I had been thinking about writing about meatpacking workers for a long time, because I grew up in this state, which is the home of the largest meatpacking company in the United States. And I'd been thinking about how I knew meatpacking workers. I knew they existed. I had seen them, but I knew so little about their lives. And in Arkansas, I think it's a particularly difficult thing to investigate because it is the home of this global, you know, multi-billion dollar company. And workers know beyond a shadow of a doubt, not only that there will be retribution, which could take the form of being fired or, you know, being blacklisted. A lot of them talked about, not only will I not get a job at Tyson's, I will not get a job at any, you know, related company. And a lot of these workers are, as you said, they're undocumented. They are children. They are imprisoned people. They do not necessarily speak English, and many of them are illiterate. So there's all these barriers to them getting other jobs, and often they're supporting family and extended family, and they have other family members working at Tyson. So even if they aren't worried about themselves, they're worried about their family members. So it was hard to build relationships because I knew as they knew that they, you know, there's a cost to speaking out.
I think most people have some vague idea that Tyson makes chicken. I'm not sure they know the way that you document in the book, just how powerful they are, not just in the country, but especially in your part of the country, in Arkansas. Could you describe that a little bit?
Tyson, Tyson has a budget that's many times the size of the state of Arkansas. It's a company, it's the largest meat packer in the United States and the second largest globally. I interviewed workers in Arkansas, really a handful of workers. It took me 4 years to interview maybe two dozen people, essentially, that I followed over the 4 years. I'm really looking at what are the daily lives of these workers like, because I've just seen so little about them and about their, what is it like when you're working 10 hours or 12 hours a day at in Arkansas it's chicken processing, but in other states, they process pork and beef and et cetera. That's what I was curious about. What does this look like on a daily basis, and what is the impact for these workers and their families?
So you started, there are kind of two big events in this book. One is this chemical spill that happened back in 2011 that sent a lot of those workers to the hospital, and many of them, as you say in the story, had these lingering after effects. And then COVID and the pandemic in 2020 and beyond that hit some of those same people a second time, and obviously other people there too. What are, in your mind, sort of the through lines in your story between those two events?
Well, so I started reporting this in 2020, at the height of COVID, and I was really interviewing workers about the conditions that they were facing during COVID, which included, they discussed being pressured to work after they'd tested positive for COVID, the lack of social distancing, because anything that will decrease profits, and that would be social distancing, is going to decrease profits because you need people on the line close to each other. And, letting people quarantine for COVID is going to decrease profits. So nothing that's going to decrease profits was on the table. And so workers were working with COVID, and obviously COVID spread like wildfire, and meatpacking plants were second only to prisons in terms of the spread of COVID. I was really talking about COVID, but then when workers started to die of COVID, their family members, a lot of them discussed a chemical accident that occurred in 2011. And so several of the workers who died were first in the chemical accident. It was an ammonia accident, and it damaged their lungs, basically ate up their lungs to different degrees. And so they were, in their own words, they were slowly dying. And when COVID arrived, they knew they were going to die. They predicted their own death, in a sense. I really wanted to look at all these issues because this is not just an issue at Tyson. This is an issue across the meatpacking industry, the use of chemicals and chemical accidents. And when you have workers in some plants, workers might speak 20, 30 different languages, and they do not always have translators on hand, for example, for the Karen people from Myanmar, or all these different languages. So people are mixing chemicals, and often maybe they aren't trained. Maybe it is the instructions are not in their language. There's all these like issues related to language that kind of go unseen or undiscussed.
I guess my lack of knowledge, I kind of assumed that everyone at these plants, by and large, was Hispanic. But as you detail, there are people from lots of other places in the world there too, as well.
Yeah, so the Latinx population is the largest portion of, percentage of labor at in meat packing. But, in Arkansas, I've seen workers from Vietnam, Thailand, Myanmar, the Marshall Islands. The largest population in the world outside of the Marshall Islands lives in Arkansas, and they work primarily at Tyson. The population from the Marshall Islands saw the greatest number of COVID deaths. I really wanted to look at, all these different dynamics related to language and cultural barriers, and people either being illiterate or not knowing their rights and all of these things.
The people you talk to describe in pretty excruciating detail what this work does to their bodies. The thing that I kept coming back to was their hands.
Well, when I started interviewing workers, I would ask each person, what is your job? And it was a fascinating part of this work, because they would say things like, one person said, I wash the blood and guts and chicken poop off of chicken feet, and so that's their job all day long. Or I throw salt on, into the chicken nugget mix. Or I open, boxes of frozen meat with a crowbar. And so anyway, I wanted to understand their work. And a key thing that happened is that I was provided with a mentor by the Logan Nonfiction Program, which is a retreat that I attended. And my mentor was Mark Bowden, who's the author of Black Hawk Down. And one of the things he said is he said, "You think you know what they're doing, but you need to ask them to show you with their hands what, you know, where's the knife, where are the cuts, how many seconds does it take, what does it look like?" And that was a huge game changer for me because it was true. I had a vision of what they were doing, but when they showed me, and when they said, you know, "I take 2 seconds, you know, to dip, you know, dig the knife into the when they're cutting chicken wings to cut, you know, this chicken wing, that chicken wing, total take 3 seconds, then I take 1 second to sharpen my knife, and then I'm back." That led to me focusing on their hands, on the movements, and that eventually led me into like their sleep and dreams, where they were telling me that they worked in their sleep, which was something I never in my life would have thought of, and I think is really interesting and kind of nightmarish in terms of thinking of people being turned into machines in a sense.
You know, there were many, many things in this book that were sort of outrageous in terms of the practices that Tyson was doing. And one, it was such a small thing, but for some reason, it really got to me was the idea that when they would go to the doctor, the company doctor, sometimes they would be sent away to buy Advil or whatever it was at like the company vending machine. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, this was there's a vending machine for pain meds, and so that's a detail. There were so many details like that, you know, that struck me, and that when workers would go to, there's an on-site medical clinic that often they're just told ice, and then, you know, take some pain meds, and then they go to the vending machine to pay for that. So there's so many tiny internal things where workers are paying for their own care in many ways, and I wanted to capture that.
It also seemed nightmarish in a sense, the rigmarole that the workers would have to go through just to get, you know, a medical claim or to get to go to an outside doctor. Tyson has kind of built this closed system, right, where the workers are never supposed to go outside it to get any kind of care or treatment or anything like that.
It is a close, and this is, I mean, so many of these things. I did not know that Tyson had, you know, an on a system of on-site clinics. And so when workers talked about it, I was confused. You know, they're not allowed to go outside of that system unless they pay for everything themselves, which is obviously a very large barrier for most of these workers. They just can't afford it. You know, I was trying to figure out like, how do I learn more about this system? Because I've never seen an interview ever with a nurse. And that was the hardest, maybe the hardest thing I did was getting a nurse on the record discussing this. And that really gave me a vision of what it was like for the nurses who are often, you know, she said that they feel pressured to deliver what, you know, the company's, you know, bottom line is that they want to be able to say that they have essentially a very low number or no injuries on any given day. And that is the goal. This is a good example. One of the workers who was in the 2011 chemical accident, I actually visited her just a few days ago, and she is still fighting for disability. So that was in 2011, and today she has a lawyer. I don't know what's happening with that process, but you know, how many years have to pass and how much do you have to suffer in order to get you know, to get your claim through.
One thing that really struck me as I'm hearing the stories of the people in this book, as bad as stuff at Tyson is and was for them, they often came from places that were worse. You know, they had this sort of American dream, and this is what it turned out to be. Did many of the folks there, were they able to talk to you in sort of those terms?
I mean, yeah, a lot of workers, like even one of them, the main workers in the story, who I had to give everybody pseudonyms, but he told me he would have loved to be a journalist, you know. And he's someone, he's married, he has 4 kids, and truly, he was so curious and dedicated and interested in investigating things that he saw. You know, these workers do have dreams, and often it depends on whether they have access to more education or support, and especially on their, on their status, whether they're undocumented and all of these things. And another worker who's in the book, who was in the chemical accident, her dream was actually to open a hair salon, but after the chemical accident, she cannot be around any chemicals. She can't even wash clothes with laundry soap, for example. And so she said that Tyson, ended her dream of opening a hair salon. And so a lot of these workers, they're hoping that they can, that they can use this job, which, they're thankful to have a job, and they're very hardworking, and really what they're asking for is safe work conditions.
So you have some responses throughout the story from Tyson spokespeople and that sort of thing. Were they aware as you were talking to folks and reporting this book that you were doing it? And if not, like when did they sort of become aware?
So every time I wrote an article, I was in communication with the public relations director at Tyson, because anytime you're writing something, you send, the company a list of bullet points, the main points of your article, and you give them time to respond to anything that they want to respond to. In the time that I did this, over 4 years, there were three different public relations directors. Once I sent them the email, then they would contact, for example, the editors of the publication I was working with and write something about how they were unsure how anyone could prove that I was telling the truth, and how could this publication make sure that I was telling the truth. And that just slows things down, because then the publication needs to maybe consult lawyers or craft a response. And then they did things like, in the time that they were given to respond to certain things, they wouldn't respond. But then once the article was published, they would write the publication and say that they hadn't been given a chance to respond. So it just, it made, things a little bit more tense, I would say.
So what this book kind of culminates in is a bunch of the workers there filed a class action suit against Tyson. And my understanding is it was for their actions or inactions during COVID, right? And so where does that stand now?
They lost the lawsuit. It was filed in Arkansas is the first thing. So while I had great hopes, that I would be able to end my book with an inspiring win, as an Arkansan, knowing the reality of Arkansas, I had, a lot of doubts that it would go anywhere. The judge shut it down almost immediately, and it was related to something I discussed earlier in my book, which is that Arkansas is a state that passed limited liability legislation, meaning that companies can't be held responsible for anything related to COVID. So I think it was incredibly important that workers organized and stated, this is how your actions as a company have affected my family, and that they're continuing to organize. They're not done. And that's really the point of what I'm writing about, is that these workers are organizing themselves, and we need to be listening to them.
Well, that's what I wanted to kind of a two-part question, I guess. Does that organization, how is that continuing? And also the people who stepped forward and were named in the lawsuit, did they face retribution or are they facing any consequences for having been willing to step up?
That is a really good question, and that's something, that I have worried about. And this past weekend, I was in Northwest Arkansas, and so I visited several workers, and I was asking them about that. One thing to note is that of the workers in my book, many either died or were fired or now on disability. There's very few who were actually still at Tyson at this time, but the ones who are there said that they have not faced retaliation over the lawsuit. But I think part of that could be that, this is becoming a more public issue. Usually in Arkansas does not report on Tyson in general. I mean, except for to say nice, they donated money, they built a school, or whatever they did. So there's really not that much in terms of investigation about Tyson. And so I think they're just used to flying under the radar.
When we come back, Alice Driver talks about the exchange of letters her mother had for decades with Maurice Sendak.
They're darling, they're beautiful, they're funny, It's like as if Maurice were alive in front of you.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Alice Driver. I sort of make a habit of learning Southern small towns, but you are from one I have never heard of. Could you first of all say it? Because I'm not even sure how to pronounce it.
I am from Oak, Arkansas. It is a town of, my mom says there's 179 people in this town. I'm not sure how she knows that, but it's a very small town in the Ozark Mountains. And there's, for example, there's no stoplights. My parents live on a dirt road. There's no cell service.
Your mom and dad were both, or I guess are both, artists. Is that right? Mm-hmm. So you grew up in a household where they were making art all the time?
My dad is a potter, a wood-fired potter, and my mom is a weaver. And they moved to the Ozarks in the 70s as a part of the Back to the Land movement with the idea that they wanted to build their own house and make art so that they would own the land, own the house, and they would have really low overhead. And so I really did see them, you know, the way that they managed making art, which is a whole question that we all face. And so I feel lucky to, you know, to have that.
And maybe by the time you came along, some of this was resolved, but how did that land with their Northwest Arkansas neighbors back in the 70s?
Well, you know, they came in, my dad's one of five brothers, and they bought land together initially. Initially, everyone was living in tents, and then they were living communally. And then, you know, people started building their own houses. And there were other people in the area who were part of the Back to Land movement. So there was a contrast, you know, between people who were, you know, long time people who've lived in the Ozarks. You know, the Ozarks is a very conservative, generally very conservative place. But there is a crossover that's interesting to me, you know, with conservatives from the Ozarks. And for example, with my parents, who were part of the Back to Land movement, which is that they all believe in self-sufficiency, like in building things, like in building your own house and growing your own food. So there are a lot of things that I think that people respected about, you know, about my parents when they came to the land.
That reminds me of a question I forgot to ask you earlier, which is how all this reporting you did on Tyson, if it changed the way you eat.
I mean, this book did change the way I eat. I mean, I did grow up in a, you know, my parents are pretty self-sufficient and, you know, they buy meat from neighbors. Like they have like half a pig in the freezer. So I've always been, you know, I think pretty conscious about my choices, but writing this book for my own, you know, mental health, because even just receiving images from, you know, meatpacking plants, workers would send me stuff and complain about worms and weevils and blood. And so I just said, okay, I'm a pescatarian. I still eat fish. But I just cut out meat altogether just so that I could, to help my mental health while I was working on this.
Do you see, common threads in the kinds of stories you're drawn to?
Yeah, I've always worked kind of at the intersection of social justice, human rights, and gender equality. And I try, you know, I really try and focus on for including, you know, the stories of women specifically, and especially with this meatpacking story, all of the initial the organization Vince Ramos was founded by 16 immigrant women, most of them working in meatpacking.
And that organization was sort of the kind of the group that where the workers started organizing, right?
Yeah, it's the only organization in Arkansas that specifically supports meat and poultry processing workers, and which is a really brave thing to do in this state.
I wanted to ask about two other projects. One is a story that you did that I think has gotten some awards about Salvadoran lobster fishermen, if I got that right.
It's Honduran,
Honduran, I'm sorry. As I've read you describe kind of how you got that story, that also just seemed to be a fairly high degree of difficulty. Could you sort of explain what that story was and how you went about getting it?
I was in Honduras for one project, and someone had told me about lobster divers on the Mosquito Coast of Honduras, which is a very remote area of Honduras. And I was just, I had never in my life heard, you know, that on a commercial scale, individuals would dive for lobsters. I'm a certified diver. And I was just wondering, what does that look like? Because I was told, oh, these divers are diving 15 hours a day. And if you've taken a diving course, you know, they tell you to limit yourself to, I think, 3 hours or something, might be a little bit more than that. But I was trying to, I was like, you know, is this true? And if this is true, what does this look like? And so I freelanced. So I applied for funding, but I didn't get funding to do the story. I do this sometimes, but I said, I'm going to report this story and I'm going to sell it. And I'm going to hopefully I'll make back the money I invested in it. And I have a photographer that I work with in Mexico City, Jackie Muñello, who often will do these projects with me. So it's a quite complicated story. So we went there to, you know, to look at this lobster diving operation, which provides lobsters for the U.S. market. And the story, you know, initially I had no idea it was going to intersect with Walmart and the Walton family, which is the other huge Arkansas company that's a global company. And so that was fascinating to me because the story ended up being about the Walton family and how involved they are in the global seafood chain. And it was extremely complex because it's not like a cause and an effect. It's like, this is what, you know, the global seafood chain looks like. Here's the reality. And here's what organizations say that they're doing to make things more sustainable.
It also looked like you took some kind of dicey boat rides as part of that story.
Yes, we did. So it was one of those things where we were supposed to fly to the Mosquito Coast of Puerto Lempira. And it's a tiny plane and only leaves, let's say, once a day, because still after the pandemic, things were not, you know, on than a normal schedule. But there was the tiny plane was full when we got there. So an organization that was working with lobster divers said, oh, you can take the boat. And I thought, oh, I don't get seasick. You know, and of course, like all things, it was supposed to be, I don't know, it was supposed to be like 4 hours or something, but it was basically a motor boat, and it was across the open ocean. And I was with Jackie, the photographer, and it was, I think I could say that's the only time that I thought maybe we're going to die, because they left late, the waves were huge. So you're coming up on these huge waves and then you're just dropping. And then they put a black plastic bag over us, and the boat's full of gasoline that they're carrying, and there's no air. And Jackie actually passed out and vomited. And I thought, you know, and then it ended up being 8 hours. And so it was like, there's no help anyway. So I'm holding her and like trying to clean the vomit off of her. And, you know, thank goodness she came to and she was okay. But I always tell her, like, she's done a lot of projects with me, and it was very, very intense. And it was something that neither of us expected, because we're both like, oh, we've done boat rides, we don't get seasick. And this was, it was just not, boat ride is not the correct description.
So you have another project going on that is in almost every way completely different. And this is a book of letters between your mom and Maurice Sendak of Where the Wild Things Are and other great works. How in the world did that come about?
This is a very interesting story because so I came to Arkansas, I got the funding to work on the meatpacking article. What happens, I'm interviewing workers, many of whom have COVID, and I'm doing interviews in person, obviously outdoors, trying to wearing a mask and all that, but I got COVID. For me, the symptoms were I was sleeping for about a month, I was sleeping about 15 hours a day. I hadn't sold the book. I had no money because I freelance. The pandemic really upset my financial situation. And I ran out of money, and then I was sleeping all day and I couldn't turn in work. And so after that month, I moved in with my parents in Oak. I had been living down the road renting a house from my cousin. And my mom one day left. She left me a just a, like a manila envelope. And I opened it, and it was full of letters from Maurice Sendak. And so I knew Maurice was. He was a family friend. He had met my mom when she was a child, and I had met him, but I didn't know he had sent her 60 years worth of letters starting from when she was 8 years old.
Wow, and so were they just like pen pals, basically?
Well, what do I do when I look at the letters, which are illustrated? They're darling, they're beautiful, they're funny. It's like as if Maurice were alive in front of you. And so I start talking, interviewing my family members, not for a project. I didn't think this was going to be a project, just because I said, Mom, you met Maurice when you were she they met when she was 7 and he was 28. And I'm in some way, what was how did you meet? And, oh, well, he was friends with my grandparents. My grandparents were abstract painters from Charleston, South Carolina. And so then I'm like, okay, well, how did he become friends with my grandparents? Because Maurice is from New York and my grandparents lived in Charleston. One afternoon, I was talking to my dad. My dad said, well, Maurice called me when my grandfather William died. And I said, no. And he said, yeah, he called me to, he said, I have a confession to make. He said, yeah, William was the love of my life. So it turns out that my grandfather, who I did not know, was, you can, I mean, he was married to my grandmother for 60 years, but so you could say that he was gay or bi. My grandfather had a relationship with Maurice Sendak. Maurice was 19, and my grandfather was, I think, 30. He was in his 30s when they met. So this is early Maurice. And it just kind of like threw me. I'm like, first of all, my grandfather is. I discovered he had many relationships with men. My grandfather did. And so it just became like, okay, I've uncovered this family secret in the process of
So not just a box of letters then.
yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. One last thing. I think by the time our audience hears this conversation, your book will be out. But for the moment, it's not. And yesterday, as we're speaking, I saw that you posted a video of you unboxing the book. And for people who don't know this, and you get a box of books, the author always gets a box of books. And there's that moment when you open it and you see your book for the first time. Could you just describe what that was like for you?
So I got my box of books a week ago. My publicist had asked me to make a video, transitioning from only writing to doing more public work or is difficult. And I didn't want to open the box because I you know how you have these fears that there's a mistake somewhere in there. And so, and then I was like, oh, I need to borrow. I don't have a dog, but I wanted to borrow a dog to be in my video. And then I was like, oh, I need to go to Oak. I bet like where my parents are, which is like 2 hours from Little Rock. Anyway, it took me a whole week to just be like, okay, I sat down on the floor. I opened the book. It's beautiful. And I wanted to look at the acknowledgments because that's the part that is most emotional for me. Because there were so many people who helped me make this book a reality. And I really wanted them to know that I couldn't have done it without them.
The thing I keep coming back to after hearing Alice Driver talk about the cruel and demanding lives of chicken plant workers is that so many of them came from worse. They fled corrupt governments or hopeless villages, and many took incredibly difficult journeys just to get a shot at the American dream. Instead, they found themselves taken advantage of by companies such as Tyson, who have all the leverage, up to and including the pain pills that injured workers have to buy out of the company vending machine. This is not the promise of the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island. Instead, it's a shadow America, where the people with the least power are forced to do the hardest work for the lowest pay and the least chance of escape. Also, the rest of us can go buy a cheap box of chicken nuggets. We owe those workers better than that. Companies like Tyson are never going to be generous on their own. It takes work like Alice Driver's book to shine the light into those shadows and make this country a place where our newcomers do not simply trade one form of hell for another. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Wharf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.